This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 218 to 219 from the chapter Al-Baqarah from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizkar.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Inna alladhina amanu walladhina hajaru wajahadu fi sabilillah. Inna alladhina amanu walladhina hajaru wajahadu في سبيل الله أولئك يرجون رحمة الله أولئك يرجون رحمة الله والله غفور رحيم. يسألونك عن الخمر والميسر قل فيهما إثم كبير ومنافع للناس كبير ومنافع للناس وإثمهما أكبر من نفعهما ويسألونك ماذا ينفقون قل العفو وكذلك يبين الله لكم الآيات لعلكم تتفكرون ويسألونك ماذا ينفقون قل العفو كذلك يبين الله لكم الآيات لعلكم تتفكرون.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Surely those who believed and those who fled their home and strove hard in the way of Allah, these hope for the mercy of Allah, and Allah is forgiving, merciful. They ask you about intoxicants and games of chance. Say, in both of them there is a great sin and means of profit for men, and their sin is greater than their profit. And they ask you as to what they should spend. Say, what you can spare. Thus does Allah make clear to you the communications that you may ponder.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
8th of December, Israeli forces continue to kill civilians and destroy buildings across Gaza Strip, more than 2 months after the ceasefire agreement. Thailand's military launches airstrikes along its disputed border with Cambodia after one Thai soldier was killed and four others were wounded in a fresh round of clashes. And the Venezuelan army swears in thousands of new soldiers amid the US's escalating threats of military aggression against the country. The Israeli forces continue to kill and injure Palestinian civilians across the Gaza Strip more than 2 months after the ceasefire agreement with Hamas. Israeli forces continued the violations of the ceasefire agreement on Sunday, launching attacks on the southern and central parts of the territory. Gaza's medical sources reported at least 6 new fatalities and 17 injuries within 24 hours. The fatalities included a Palestinian child who was killed by Israeli forces' gunfire in the Al-Bawasi area of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. Another child was injured by Israeli gunfire in the At-Tafah neighborhood of Gaza City. More than 370 civilians have been killed since the ceasefire took effect. The death toll from the Israeli genocide since October 2023 has risen to 70,360, leaving more than 171,000 others injured. Israeli forces also demolished buildings and opened fire in areas where they remained stationed east of Khan Yunis, as the regime's artillery shelled areas north of Rafah, also in south of Gaza. The International Committee of the Red Cross says Israel continues to prevent its teams from visiting Palestinian prisoners despite growing reports about the deteriorating health conditions. The Red Cross said its teams have been unable to visit Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails since the Gaza genocide began in October 2023. The Red Cross says it is working to intensify efforts to reach detainees despite the restrictions placed on its operations. Earlier, the Palestinian Commission of Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs warned of the critical health conditions of Palestinians held in Israeli jails. Even Israel's own media have corroborated those reports. The Times of Israel has reported severe weight loss, clear signs of malnutrition and overcrowding in the regime's jails. It also confirmed repeated physical abuse of Palestinians by prison guards. More than 9,300 Palestinians are currently imprisoned by Israel, including women and children. Reports say detainees face torture, abuse, malnutrition and medical neglect, resulting in a death of dozens. Robert Inlakesh says conditions for Palestinian abductees, particularly in the occupied West Bank, have worsened since October 2023. Let us hear more.
It's a problem, particularly in the West Bank, which has afflicted a large portion of the male population in specific. But when we're looking at post-October 7, 2023, those conditions have gotten much worse. We're looking now at a situation where these prisoners have been starved, beaten routinely, sexually assaulted, subjected to all sorts of forms of rape, gang rape, rape with sticks, the use of dogs to do as such to them. So we're looking at very, very extreme cases. And there's around roughly still 11,000 Palestinians who are held by the Israelis in both prison and then as well military detention camps. And the two are actually different. One is the Israeli military system and military courts, which either produces these administrative detainee orders, which is held without a charge orders, or it eventually convicts Palestinians in its kangaroo court system that has a 99.9% conviction rate. But the others are those who were kidnapped and held hostage from Gaza. And these prisoners, or these hostages, are being subjected to some of the worst forms of torture imaginable.
The UN Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territory has praised the growing European boycott of the Eurovision Song Contest over Israel's presence in the competition. Francesco Albanese called it a sign of shifting public conscience following a long time inaction on the regime's crimes. In a social media post, Albanese lamented that Israel has not been suspended from the UN and other international forums, as well as UEFA, FIFA, FIBA or cultural events. She argued that the institutional silence on Israel's crimes has allowed the Gaza genocide to be normalized and continue unabated. Albanese was referring to a Eurovision boycott movement that has gained momentum in recent days. Slovenia, Spain, the Netherlands and Ireland have already announced that they will not participate, citing the contest's failure to hold a vote on banning Israel. Iceland has also indicated that it will hold further discussions before a final decision. The Israeli forces have killed another Palestinian young man in the West Bank as the regime ratchets up its violent attacks on Palestinian towns and refugee camps across the occupied territory. According to local sources, the Israeli soldiers opened fire on a vehicle at the main entrance to the town of Azun, east of Qalqilia, killing a young man and wounding two others. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society says its medical crews were prevented from reaching the scene. It added that Israeli troops abducted the body of the victim and those who were wounded, one of whom in critical condition. Following the incident, the Israeli forces closed the main entrance to the village of Nabi Elias, east of Qalqilia, which leads to Azun, restricting Palestinians' movement. In a separate incident in the town of Birkin, west of Jenin, a 12-year-old child was wounded by Israeli forces in the knee as he was playing on his bicycle. Our West Bank correspondent Nakahama joined us earlier with the latest updates on the ongoing Israeli atrocities across the occupied territory.
Unfortunately, it's not a new incident that is being implemented or that is happening over here in the occupied West Bank, as the Israeli forces are intensifying their raids and their attacks upon Palestinian cities, and they are keeping their pretenses and their reasons ready, because they are all the time the initial statement by the Israeli forces for such attack is that they were threatened by the Palestinians. The Palestinians have attempted to stab them or to ram them over by his car, or similar pretenses, just like we have seen in the similar incident in Al-Khalil yesterday, where the surveillance cameras clearly showed the Israeli forces executing two Palestinians in cold blood in Al-Khalil. The same situation happened today in the village of Azun to the east of Qalqilia. According to eyewitnesses, no threat was imposed by the Palestinians who were shot upon the Israeli forces whatsoever, but the Israeli forces opened live ammunition against those groups of Palestinians, killing one of them, injuring another two, and then detaining the three of them despite the critical injury that one of them sustained.
Nationwide rallies have been held in Australia in a show of support for the Palestinian people in Gaza. Demonstrators have condemned Israel's violations of the ceasefire in Gaza, urging the Australian government to stop arms deliveries to the regime. Max Chivilly reports from Brisbane.
Rallies were held on Sunday in major Australian cities in support of Palestinians in Gaza. The rallies took place under the name "The Genocide Continues." Protesters denounced continued Israeli attacks and restrictions on aid entry into Gaza despite a ceasefire that took effect in early October. In Brisbane, about 1,000 people took to the streets, rejecting a plan proposed by US President Donald Trump to end the Gaza war.
I have family in Gaza, and they're in Jabalia, and they're completely under siege. This peace plan is not a plan for peace. This peace plan is a plan for further occupation and the further annexation of land that is not Israeli land.
Last week, some media revealed that Australia continued to transfer to Israel parts for the F-35 fighter jets and other materials, even on passenger aircraft, until October this year.
Last September, Australia recognized Palestine as a sovereign state, becoming one of more than 150 countries to do so. However, pro-Palestine advocates in Brisbane believe that much more is needed from the Australian government to satisfy its obligations under international law.
It's not enough, but there's also a lot more to happen there. There is recognizing that the genocide has been unfolding in the past 2 years, recognizing that there are approximately 100,000 Palestinians who have been killed. At least 83% of them are civilians and innocent people, women and children.
More protests in solidarity with the besieged Palestinians are expected to be organized in various Australian cities before Christmas festivities. Max Civili, Brisbane.
Tunisia is preparing to launch a nationwide initiative aiming to gather 1 million signatures to criminalize normalization of ties with the Israeli regime. The move follows regional developments triggered by the Trump-brokered Abraham Accords and comes as civil society intensifies pressure on the parliament to pass an anti-normalization law. Iskander Nawar reports from Tunis.
Tunisia's anti-normalization movement is entering a new phase. Civil society groups have announced the national initiative to gather 1 million signatures to push parliament to adopt an explicit law criminalizing normalization with the Israeli regime. The campaign builds on years of public opposition reinforced by the Trump-brokered Abraham Accords, which reignited fears of regional pressure on Tunisia to follow suit.
This initiative enjoys broad popular support. Our goal is to collect 1 million signatures to criminalize normalization in Tunisia. Since the Abraham Accords, we witnessed growing public concern and we started raising awareness across the region, where we found strong and consistent backing.
But organizers say the process will take time. Signature collection has not yet begun, as activists work to establish a secure legal mechanism for protecting personal data, a major concern among supporters of the initiative.
We began distributing flyers across different governorates, and we are now working on the legal framework for handling personal data in coordination with the Personal Data Protection Authority and the Interior Ministry to ensure full protection for citizens.
Inside the parliament, the legislative path remains uncertain. Although lawmakers submitted a draft law to criminalize normalization, the process stalled after the speaker relayed that the presidency had warned such legislation could harm Tunisia's external national security.
Parliament has already submitted and voted on the draft law, but it was suspended and remains pending. I believe the 1 million signatures initiative can support and intensify public pressure to move the law forward.
As activists finalize the legal groundwork, the campaign highlights a national debate balancing public pressure, data protection, and the political sensitivity of the proposed law. As Tunisia moves toward launching its 1 million signature campaign, the key question is how public mobilization, data safeguards, and political institutions will converge to advance a law that remains both sensitive and highly contested. Iskander Nawar, Tunisia.
Calls grow for more countries to boycott the Eurovision Song Contest in opposition to Israel's inclusion in the competition. Ireland, Spain, the Netherlands, and Slovenia have already confirmed they will not take part in the event next May. Jerome Hughes reports from Dublin.
It may be just a song contest, but analysts say this could be the moment that triggers long-awaited international pressure on the Israeli regime over its crimes against humanity. Because Israel will take part, Ireland will not participate in the 2026 Eurovision Song Contest next May. And state broadcaster RTE is also refusing to air the event.
This is great for to see Ireland boycotting. And I wish to see my own home country, Norway, do this exactly same thing where we have been discussing the same topic as you guys in terms of boycotting this year's Eurovision if Israel's going to participate.
Ireland will not be a participant in next year's Eurovision Song Contest.
The same step has been taken by public broadcasters in Spain, the Netherlands and Slovenia, generating widespread international coverage. Campaigners say this alone is a major victory, but they insist pressure must now intensify on EU leaders to seize the moment and impose tough sanctions on Tel Aviv.
I am ashamed to be European at the moment because the European Union is doing nothing at all. It's not doing nothing to stop the genocide, it's contributing to the genocide.
The European Broadcasting Union, which oversees Eurovision, moved swiftly to ban Russia, yet has taken no such action against Israel. Activists argue that if a major country like Germany were to withdraw, the message would be impossible to ignore. But they say Berlin is unlikely to act due to lingering guilt over World War II.
We are seeing a genocide, you know, in front of our eyes. So you can get away from this guilt feeling and try to solve this problem.
For its part, Irish broadcaster RTE says it would be unconscionable for Ireland to be involved in the Eurovision Song Contest, given the appalling loss of life in Gaza and the humanitarian crisis there. While the decision by RTE has been broadly welcomed here in Ireland, pressure continues on the Irish government to cut all trade ties with Israel and also use its influence in Brussels to encourage other EU countries to do the same. Jerome Hughes at Government Buildings, Dublin.
Thailand's military has launched airstrikes along its disputed border with Cambodia after clashes that killed one Thai soldier and wounded four others. Thailand's army spokesman Major General Win Thai Sovaraya said country's aircraft targeted positions in Chong Bak area in northeastern Thailand following alleged Cambodian fire. He added that the military was expediting evacuation support for civilians in border areas. Meanwhile, Cambodia's defense ministry confirmed the raids in two provinces, saying it had not retaliated. The incident is the latest flare-up since the July ceasefire that ended 5 days of fighting, which left 48 dead and displaced 300,000 people. Tensions have persisted amid long-standing disputes over the 817-kilometer frontier. The Venezuelan army has sworn in thousands of new soldiers as the U.S. intensifies military pressure on the oil-rich nation.
In these moments, when imperialism threatens our homeland and our people in an illegal, deceitful, false, and arrogant manner, young people are coming by the thousands to join the Bolivarian National Armed Force, to join the General Directorate of Military Counterintelligence, to join the Presidential Honor Guard.
Some 5,600 new soldiers were sworn in following President Nicolas Maduro's call to expand military recruitment in the face of Washington's threats of military aggression. Maduro's call came after the U.S. deployed a fleet of warships, including the world's largest aircraft carrier, to the Caribbean under the pretext of combating drug trafficking. Washington has also carried out deadly strikes on Venezuelan boats at sea, killing more than 80 people. Maduro says the U.S. deployment is aimed at overthrowing him and seizing the country's oil reserves. The U.S. President Donald Trump recently threatened Venezuela with an imminent land invasion, once again accusing Caracas of aiding the flow of drugs and migrants into the U.S. And that's the end of this news bulletin. Thank you so much for staying with us.
Burning and keeping the light alive. turning secrets to power. And bury his paints in the desert. A man who knows the ways in the heavens better than the ways on earth.
Ocean of Dua.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters in faith, and all of you who are listening to RIB English Radio. You're listening to the program, The Ocean of Dua. And this program, we try to discuss the different concepts and meanings and try to interpret the passages of different supplications that have been issued by the Ma'sumin, peace be upon them. We were continuing the discussion on the supplication of Sabah, Dua al-Sabah, and let's listen to one passage of this supplication, and we'll be right back, and we'll talk more about that passage.
صلي اللهم على الدليل إليك في الليل الأليل والماسك من أسبابك بحبل الشرف الأطول والناصع الحسب في ذروة الكاهل الأعبال والثابت القدم على زحاليفها في الزمن الأول وعلى آله الأخيار المصطفين الأبرار.
Okay, the passage that we just listened to was this. وَالنَّاصِعِ الْحَسَبِ فِي ذِرْوَةِ الْكَاهِلِ الْأَعْبَلِ. It translates to, whose pure lineage, evident at the summit of stout shoulders. Again, this is a description and praise of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, who's saying that his lineage, his pure lineage, the ma'sumin, the 13 infallibles from his lineage, they are at the summit of stout shoulders. Now again, we have to know how these words relate to each other. When we read it, it's somehow really distant from our imagination and intellect. But in Arabic, it makes perfect sense. It's not something that is, you know, something confusing or something that's too metaphorical for the normal person to understand. At the summit of stout shoulders, it means that they are in a very high station. This is what it's trying to say.
Bless, O Allah, the guide to you in the darkest night, who of your robes clings to the cord of the longest nobility, whose pure lineage evident at the summit of stout shoulders, and whose feet were entrenched in spite of slippery places in ancient times. And bless his household, the good, chosen, and pious.
Thank you, Allah, now that we're here, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The next passage reads, وَالثَّابِتِ الْقَدَمِ عَلَى زَحَالِيفِهَا فِي الزَّمَنِ الْأَوَّلِ. And whose feet were entrenched in spite of slippery places in ancient time. Okay, so again, it's about Prophet Muhammad. It's the continuation of the previous descriptions and eulogies about his holiness. It says that Prophet Muhammad, his feet were firm on the ground, entrenched, ثابت القدم, they were steady, in spite of slippery places in ancient time. What does that mean, slippery places? It means that it was easy to make mistakes and be misguided at that time. Okay, again, this is, you know, something Arabic that when we want to translate into English, it becomes a little problematic. Just imagine that you are in a very slippery place, but you have these special shoes that allows you to walk in that slippery place without falling. Okay, but not everyone is capable of walking firmly in that slippery place. This is an allusion to, again, the period of Jahiliyyah, al-zaman al-awwal. Okay, where people, they did not know anything. Most of them did not know how to read or write. They thought that idols were their god, and they didn't believe in one god. They worshipped idols, and they didn't know a lot of things about the world, the realities, the spiritual realities. And Prophet Muhammad, he was sent to them, and he guided them, and he made sure that they wouldn't make as many mistakes like they used to. And he brought them out of darkness into light. Another thing about this is that we understand that the prophet, he was ma'soom, just based on this passage. Because who was the one who was giving him these firm and steady feet? Who could it be other than Allah? Was it like himself? Like, what was so special about him that Allah, that he was, you know, athabit al-qadam, that his feet were entrenched? It was because he was a prophet, because he was to guide the people. So when there is a place where everyone is going in the wrong direction, there has to be someone who is able to guide them, to be able to, you know. Of course, this passage doesn't really try to say that, you know, they were in utter darkness and the prophet was better than, of course he was better than them. It's trying to say that despite the fact that there were many slippery places, again, see, I'm saying in Arabic, the word is zahalif. It's one word. But in English, we don't have one word that can convey the meaning of zahalif. We have to say slippery places. Again, slippery place doesn't really make sense in English because it's not one word. It's two words. This passage means that there were many means of being slipped, falling, being misguided, yet the prophet, his feet were steady. Despite of all of those false beliefs that the Arabs had at that time, and how they would say that the angels are the daughters of Allah, and we don't need them, we should have sons, things like that. Prophet Muhammad, he wasn't like that. He was absolutely free from all of those mistakes and error that they were in. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of The Ocean of Dua. Until next time, I leave you in the care and mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah. Ya Allah, ya Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you by my side. I wish to be close to you.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Palestine Declassified. I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we provide an in-depth analysis of the Zionist entity's criminal behaviour and the effort it puts into influencing international policymakers and global public opinion. In today's show, we'll be looking at Jeffrey Epstein's role in trying to damage the reputations of two esteemed academics, John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt. This was after they wrote a book about the pro-Israel lobby's disproportionate influence over US foreign policy. In our first report, Latif Arabachakra describes how Epstein, who was a Zionist asset, and the notorious Zionist lawyer, Alan Dershowitz, invented allegations of anti-Semitism against Mearsheimer and Walt.
Recently released emails of Jeffrey Epstein contain evidence that the convicted paedophile and Zionist intelligence agent collaborated with Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz to discredit the landmark 2006 study by Mearsheimer and Walt, titled The Israel Lobby. During the first week of April 2006, Epstein received multiple early drafts of an attack piece by Dershowitz titled Debunking the Newest and Oldest Jewish Conspiracy. Dershowitz, who also served as Epstein's defense lawyer, accused Mearsheimer and Walt of recycling discredited trash from neo-Nazi and so-called Islamist websites, accusing them of authoring a modern counterpart to the protocols of the Elders of Zion. Epstein responded to Dershowitz's email, "Terrific. Congratulations." Later, Epstein received another message from Dershowitz's email address asking Epstein to help circulate copies of the attack. Epstein replied in the affirmative, "Yes, I've started." While Mearsheimer has spent his entire career at Chicago, his co-author Stephen Walt has been professor of international relations at the Harvard Kennedy School since 1999. Epstein was a powerful figure at Harvard. He had spent years cultivating relationships at the university, donating more than $9 million between 1998 and 2008. He positioned himself as a fixer and patron for high-profile academics, including Dershowitz and economist Larry Summers, who was the president of Harvard at the time and recently apologized for his connections to Epstein. At the time, Epstein served as trustee and president of the Family Financial Office of Jewish billionaire Leslie Wexner. It donated nearly $20 million to the Kennedy School between 2000 and 2006. The Wexner Foundation's contributions underwrote core operating expenses. The foundation also funded a visiting scholar program, which allowed 10 Zionist regime officials to attend the Kennedy School each year for a one-year master's degree. Wexner is one of the most influential supporters of the Zionist colony. In 1991, he co-founded a philanthropic organization of Jewish billionaires known as the Mega Group, which uses some of its vast resources to support the genocidal colony. It reportedly had contacts with the Mossad and served as a vehicle for influence operations in the United States. Among its operations, it supported the creation of the Racist Birthright Israel program and the renewal of Hillel International, the Zionist student group, which now has over 1,000 branches, including 50 outside of the US. In other words, Epstein's collaboration with Dershowitz connects the big players of the Israel lobby to attacks on the idea that there was a powerful Israel lobby. Walt, who still works at Harvard, declined to comment on these allegations. Mearsheimer said, "I'm not surprised to see these emails, because Dershowitz and Epstein were close, and both have a passionate attachment to Israel."
As usual, I'm joined in the studio by David Miller, who's the UK's foremost scholarly critic of Israel and our resident expert. He's a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch and a senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. Our guest contributor today is the Palestinian author, poet, activist and political commentator Susan Abulhawa. Her first novel, Mornings in Jenin, was an international bestseller that was translated into 30 languages. Her other books include The Blue Between Sky and Water and Against the Loveless World. She also founded Playgrounds for Palestine in 2001 that upholds the right to play for Palestinian children. Welcome to the show. David, these emails from Jeffrey Epstein, I mean, they've seemed to be throwing up quite a lot of intriguing stories, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, there have been a lot of stories. I mean, we're discussing the attack on the Israel lobby this week, but there are many other stories about Epstein's role in geopolitics, essentially, in Côte d'Ivoire, in Africa, in Far East Asia, all sorts of involvement, of course, in line with Zionist intelligence aims and strategies, but much wider direct involvement than people have previously thought. Now, in relation to the Israel lobby thing, this is an indication, isn't it, that underlying the idea that Israel is only just an instrument of US imperialism is actually the Israel lobby saying, oh, it's not the Israel lobby. And that's the new thing about this particular story.
Yeah, is this just sort of a damage limitation exercise that they're going through?
Well, it's like, don't look at us, look elsewhere. And of course that helps. The left helped them with that by saying, oh, well, it's US imperialism, we shouldn't be looking at Zionists, and we shouldn't use the word Zionist. So it's part of that kind of area of ideas, but it does indicate that many people on the left are effectively spouting Zionist talking points.
Yeah, kind of acting as sort of useful idiots, almost, you might say. But Susan, I mean, do you think we're beginning to get a better picture of the role that was actually played by Epstein?
Yeah, for sure. Epstein's operation is not likely to be the only one of its kind also. Zionists have used sexual coercion and sexual blackmail since before Israel was formally established, even. And this is well known and documented, especially against Palestinians, but also against British officials during the Mandate period. There's a book by Daniel Halper that credibly suggested that the Monica Lewinsky tapes were used to blackmail Bill Clinton in the 90s. Israel has used honey trap operations like this to kidnap Mordecai Vanunu, for example, the man who famously blew the whistle on Israel's nuclear program. And so Israel has a long history of these tactics, and Epstein's operation is par for the course, and it's not likely to be the only one. And the second thing to know about Epstein's operation is that it was never meant to be seen, rather, in the light of scrutiny. These tactics are meant to remain in the shadows, controlling politicians, policy, and so on, beyond public view. And the fact that this story is in the public consciousness now is an aberration of how things typically work with Zionist influence. What I can say with some certainty is that what we know, namely what has been released, is the tip of the iceberg. So in addition to focusing on what these emails reveal, I think we should also focus on what has been kept hidden, because ultimately the declassification of the current documents was meant solely to quell public outrage. It was never meant to inform or even reveal. So what we don't see, I believe, is far more important for transparency, and people should not stop demanding the full disclosure of everything that they seized from and surrounding the Epstein pedophile compromise operation.
Well, David, I mean, what about Epstein assisting Dershowitz then with his attack on the book that was written by John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt?
Well, I mean, Dershowitz, of course, is famously this rabid pro-Zionist law professor at Harvard. He's also Epstein's defense lawyer in the allegations of sexual abuse and trafficking against him. He also was accused, and then some of the accusations were resiled from, of himself being involved in rape and sexual abuse. So that there's all of that. And also the emails recently released have shown Epstein, looking down his nose at Dershowitz, saying this man's crazy, of his own defense lawyer. So you can see the kind of internecine nest of vipers that these people were operating in, at the same time as helping each other with their strategies. And Epstein, in this case, helping to spread the word about Dershowitz's ridiculous attempted hatchet job on the Israel lobby.
Yeah, indeed. And I've seen Dershowitz slightly embarrassed, I think, about his relationship with Epstein. I think it was Max Blumenthal who challenged about that, and he sort of made the, well, I'm just his lawyer. I was just his representative.
Well, that's what everyone who was associated with him tried to say, wasn't it? Ehud Barak, the former Prime Minister of Israel. Yeah. Prince Andrew, not called Prince Andrew anymore, and Larry Summers, of course. The president of Harvard, who's now apologised and says he's going to step back because all these recent emails have shown that he was very close.
Susan, what's your take on Dershowitz in general? As we were just saying, he was Epstein's defence lawyer as well, wasn't he?
Dershowitz is a truly unsavory character, and that's being very generous. I actually debated him in 2010 at a literature festival in Boston because he had written a novel, if you can even call it that. It was a very badly written monument to his ego. but yes, as you say, he was indeed Epstein's lawyer, but their relationship doesn't appear to have been purely professional. It seems they were friends, perhaps good friends. Dershowitz attended his parties. He went to his island, Epstein's island, and he traveled on Epstein's Lolita plane. And let's not forget, too, that Dershowitz himself was accused by multiple women of sexual assault and sexual abuse. So there was a connection between the two men that went beyond him just being Epstein's lawyer. And also, Dershowitz is the man who managed the plea deal with the then Florida's district attorney, Alexander Acosta, who oversaw that non-prosecution agreement that truly shocked everyone.
David, would you say a bit more, will you, about this Wexner character then that Latifah mentioned in her report?
So Wexner, one of the, is it hundreds, many Jewish billionaire oligarchs in the US, as the film said, that funded the Harvard Kennedy School, not just Harvard, but the Harvard Kennedy School where Walt continues to work, and a very big player in the way in which all this kind of Zionist money went into Harvard. Summers was the president, of course, and that was part of the deal too. And Epstein as well was involved with people at Harvard in all sorts of odd sort of transhumanist research, which has been revealed in recent years too. So, but Wexner had his foundation. The foundation was effectively run by Epstein. Epstein ran his office from a house belonging to Wexner in New York. So they're very, very close relationships. And they clearly were at the center of a network of Jewish billionaires and so-called philanthropists funding Zionist causes in the US and indeed in the colony.
It's a very intriguing set of connections there, isn't it? But Susan, Epstein appears to have been heavily embedded at Harvard as well, doesn't he?
He was indeed. Epstein made it a point to infiltrate and make himself indispensable, really, in every major arena of power, whether it was at Ivy League universities, elite scientific circles, politicians, of course, heads of state, princes, kings, CEOs, and so on. And herein lies the information we really should try to get and not stop until we have full disclosure and a holistic picture of the full extent of this iceberg beneath the surface that we are really just glimpsing right now.
Well, our next report looks at who are the most influential Zionists in the United States.
It has been suggested that the emergence of these emails is ironic, since they tend to confirm the thesis of the 2006 Israel Lobby study, which was defined as a loose coalition of individuals and organizations that actively work to shape foreign policy. But do they? The mega group set up by Les Wexner, the former CEO of lingerie chain Victoria's Secret, was founded in 1991.
and first publicized in 1998. It reportedly includes 50 or so billionaires or influential Zionist figures. These reportedly include Les Wexner, Charles and Edgar Bronfman, Charles Schusterman, Ronald Lauder, and Lawrence Tisch. These oligarchs and the involvement in the mega group of Jeffrey Epstein speak of Zionist manipulation and intrigue, but these are not central to the book. Only the Bronfmans appear fleetingly in the index. In the book itself, it is a narrowly defined Israel lobby which exercises influence. The top 10 most cited organizations in the book are, with one exception, all Israel lobby groups and not formally part of the Zionist movement. In order of citation, they are AIPAC, ADL, Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, YNAP, Zionist Organization of America, Israel Policy Forum, GENSA, and American Jewish Committee. ZOA is the exception. In addition, two of the four pillars of the Zionist movement are not in the index at all. These are the American Zionist Movement, the U.S. affiliated of the World Zionist Organization, and the Jewish National Fund, the U.S. affiliate of the Zionist Land Theft Agency. The book also entirely ignores the role of oligarchs, foundations, and intelligence-connected operators using blackmail and threats. It leaves out the role of Zionist intelligence agencies. There's no discussion of Unit 8200, the Signals Intelligence Agency, which has massively penetrated the tech and media industry. In the end, the book focuses almost entirely on the most visible elements of Zionist infiltration, but on neither the Zionist movement's great engine of radicalization, which turns out thousands of radicalized genocidaires in every generation, or the massive infiltration of Zionists throughout the administrative apparatus of the U.S. state.
Because 45 years ago, there was no Palestinian people.
Since at least the Reagan presidency in the 1980s. The involvement of Lawrence Tisch and the mega group is a further example of the relationship between Zionist oligarchs and Zionist infiltration. His granddaughter, Jessica Tisch, is a Zionist extremist who is the current commissioner of the NYPD. What does the Epstein-Dershowitz affair teach us? That Zionist radicalization and infiltration are much more serious and much less an informal and loose coalition than the Israel lobby thesis claims.
So, David, I mean, this mega group appears to be quite influential then, doesn't it?
Yeah, you heard some of the names there of some of the oligarchs who involve quite well-known names. That 50 or so names are people are supposed to be involved. Mm. We don't know the names of all of them, but amongst the others are other oligarchs, billionaires. The Bronfmans are interesting and should be mentioned. The Bronfmans, of course, from the famous Canadian Zionist family who run the Seagrams, the distillers, and, of course, Wexner. They were at the top of this organization. Mm. Very, very influential, and really what it shows, I think, is the important role of billionaires and of the foundations, the family foundations that they set up in funding the whole Zionist movement, something which is not really referred to conceptually, at least, in the Israel lobby thesis. So I think that's an indication that actually, when you see something like the mega group, this shows that there is a much tighter grip on the Zionist coordination than you would think from the apparently loosely coordinated Israel lobby groups like the ADL or AIPAC or WNEP or GINSA, for example. So I think it's an indication, really, that the thesis, although people say it gives too much power to the Israel lobby, actually the thesis doesn't really understand the full way in which Zionists are able to exercise power in America.
Sure, right, okay. Well, Susan, I mean, you've been attacked and defamed by numerous Zionist groups, haven't you? In your opinion, how heavily embedded in US society are they?
Well, heavily embedded, I would say, in every aspect of U.S. society, actually, in intelligentsia, in every branch of government, every major media outlet, Hollywood, every broadcast journalism, print journalism, media outlet, gaming industry, the AI industry, all the major tech industries, the national and global banking, universities, every branch of government, as I said. And the thing is, it's like there's nothing wrong with people of various backgrounds. I mean, having like overrepresentation in any field, there's nothing wrong with that. The problem it becomes when everything that they do is focused on nurturing and promulgating a settler colonial enterprise, and it becomes, you know, even treasonous in many instances. Also, I want to say, there's been some discussion about the Israel Lobby, the book by Walton Mearsheimer. But there were several books, actually, I would say many, that preceded this book, that go all the way back to the 70s. There was, for example, the late Congressman Paul Findlay, who served 22 years in Congress, wrote a book called They Dare to Speak Out, after the lobby targeted him because he dared to suggest that maybe we should speak to the PLO.
Well, David, I mean, why do you think the Israel Lobby has such a narrow definition of Zionist influence then?
Well, to some extent, it's quite understandable. I mean, Mearsheimer and Walt are not radicals. They're not left-wing political scientists. I mean, they're realist, and I suppose centrist in U.S. terms, political scientists. And also, it was a taboo to mention the Israel Lobby. And, of course, the massive attack that was on it from Dershowitz and Epstein and all the others indicates that even a minor critique, or a milder critique, if you like, of the Israel lobby groups, that caused howls of outrage from the Zionists. So that's part of the story. But I think also the problem is that there's no proper understanding or conceptualization about what Zionism is, and how actually the Zionist movement is a fairly cohesive whole, much wider than just the question of the Israel lobby groups in the US or in the UK or indeed any other country. So there's a variety of reasons for this, and I think you've got to give all respect to Mearsheimer and Walt for doing the book in the first place, for advancing this thesis, because they've had all sorts of trouble from the right and from the Zionists as well as from the left. But then, nevertheless, we can go a lot further than that thesis went.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, sort of example, really, of the maximalist strategy that the Zionists always seem to employ, sort of backfiring. Maybe that's an issue we could perhaps return to in another show. But, Susan, I mean, some professed anti-Zionists are saying that Zionist infiltration in the West doesn't equate to Jewish supremacism. I mean, are they right or are they wrong, in your opinion?
As a Palestinian, I can tell you definitively that Zionism has always been a Jewish supremacist movement. At its core is a belief in Jewish entitlement, Jewish exceptionalism, and Jewish privilege at any cost, including genocide and destruction of other peoples who stand in their way, like Palestinians. If people feel uncomfortable with Jewish supremacism, I mean, it is what it is, but at a minimum, it is Jewish exceptionalism and Jewish entitlement.
Well, David, our report mentioned the NYPD commissioner, Jessica Tisch. I mean, can you say a bit more about her background?
Well, so she comes from this very famous Jewish oligarch family, the Tishes, right? And her grandfather was involved in the mega group. And so they're involved in all sorts of business enterprises and indeed in funding Zionist causes. She's now the commissioner of the New York Police Department, and is the one who Zohran Mamdani, the incoming mayor of New York, has said that he will work with. And she's of course a vicious fundamentalist Zionist, has addressed the ADL's conference, has denounced student demonstrators against the genocide. So this is the way in which this process of infiltration works. It's not just the oligarchs, not just the funding that they give, but the way in which there are Zionist infiltrators throughout the apparatus of government in towns like New York and in the federal apparatus as well. And that's the key problem here, is that the Israel lobby is not just Israel lobby groups, it's also Zionist infiltration across the whole society.
Do you think Mamdani was intimidated then into that decision? It seems a curious one. I think a lot of his supporters were very surprised by it.
Well, you think that that Mamdani is a sellout, or that he was always going to do that. So
interesting. Well, time will tell, I suppose. But Susan, I mean, what do you think the priorities should be then for developing a material anti-Zionist movement?
Internally, as Palestinians, we have our own priorities, in part to do with leadership and so forth. But with the global anti-Zionist movement, I think across the board, all of us should escalate and escalate and escalate our activism, our speech, our direct action, boycott, resistance, strikes, labor organizing, and just resistance by any means possible. Zionism isn't just a danger to Palestinians, it's a danger to humanity on the whole, and I think people are finally waking up to this reality.
Well, that's all we've got time for today, so I'd like to thank our guest, Susan Abulhawa, and make a date to join us on Palestine Declassified next week, when I'll be back alongside David Miller with more revelations and information that you won't find in the corporate media. But until then, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.